This is podcast number 106 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I want to tell you about Opal Stanley Whiteley. Opal's diary was another one of those accidental finds on the way to looking for something else, but two things drew me into her book. The first thing was that her name was Whiteley, and some of my most favorite people on the planet go by that name. But secondly, it was The Diary of an Understanding Heart. I'm sure you know why that intrigued me. I posted links to her books in the Mother's University Imagination Month, but I could just as well have placed it in this month's topic of nature study. It took me about one page to fall in love with this little girl. The dedication page in her Fairyland Around Us book reads, "To you, little children over the world who are dreaming of a fairyland far distant and who are longing to know the fairies, this book of the fairyland around us in God's outdoors is dedicated. And also to you grown-ups who have kept your faith in childhood and who are seeking inspiration for your work in the everyday things around you, this book is dedicated by one who loves this fairyland around us and who has found therein a bigger vision of life and of life's supreme joy, service." Opal was thought to have been born a French princess, but was raised in poverty as her adopted family moved from lumber camp to lumber camp in Oregon. Let me start by letting her tell her own story. Notice the methods her mother used to teach her and the long-lasting influence and impression they made on her even though she was very young. "Of the days before I was taken to the lumber camps, there is little I remember. As piece by piece the journal comes together, some things come back. There are references here and there in the journal of things I saw or heard or learned in those days before I came to the lumber camps. There were walks in the fields and woods. When on these walks, Mother would tell me to listen to what the flowers and trees and birds were saying. We listened together. And on the way she told me poems and other lovely things, some of which she wrote in the two books and also in others which I had not with me in the lumber camps. On the walks, and after we came back, she had me to print what I had seen and what I had heard. After that she told me of different people and their wonderful work on earth. Then she would have me tell again to her what she had told me. After I came to the lumber camp, I told these things to the trees and the brooks and the flowers. There were five words my mother said to me over and over again as she had me to print what I had seen and what I had heard. These words were what, where, when, how, why. They had a very great influence over all my observations and the recording of these observations during all the days of my childhood. And my mother, having put such strong emphasis on these five words, accounts for much of the detailed descriptions that are throughout my diary. No children I knew. There were only Mother and the kind woman who taught me and looked after me and dressed me, and the young girl who fed me. And there was Father in those few days when he was home from the far lands. Those were wonderful days, his homecoming days. Then he would take me on his knee and ride me on his shoulder and tell me of the animals and birds of the far lands. And we went for many walks, and he would talk to me about the things along the way. It was then he taught me comparer. There was one day when I went with Mother in a boat. It was a little way on the sea. It was a happy day. Then something happened and we were all in the water. Afterward, when I called for Mother, they said the sea waves had taken her and she was gone to heaven. I remember the day because I never saw my mother again. The time was not long after that day with Mother in the boat when one day the kind woman who taught me and took care of me did tell me gently that Father too had gone to heaven while he was away in the far lands. She said she was going to take me to my grandmother and grandfather, the mother and father of my father. We started, but I never got to see my dear grandmother and grandfather, whom I had never seen. Something happened on the way, and I was all alone, and I didn't feel happy. There were strange people that I had never seen before, and I was afraid of them. They made me to keep very still, and we went for no walks in the field, but we traveled a long, long way. Then it was they put me with Mrs. Whiteley. The day they put me with her was a rainy day, and I thought she was a little afraid of them, too. She took me on the train and in a stagecoach to the lumber camp. She called me Opal Whiteley, the same name as that of another little girl who was the same size as I was when her mother lost her. She took me into the camp as her own child, and so called me as we lived in the different lumber camps and in the mill town. With me I took into camp a small box. In a slide drawer in the bottom of this box were two books, which my own mother and father, the angel father and mother I always speak of in my diary, had written in. I do not think the people who put me in with Mrs. Whiteley knew about the books in the lower part of the box, for they took everything out of the top part of the box and tossed it aside. I picked it up and kept it with me, and being as I was more quiet with it in my arms, they allowed me to keep it, thinking it was empty. These books I kept always with me, until one day I shall always remember when I was about 12 years old, they were taken from the box I kept, then hid in the woods. Day by day I spelled over and over the many words that were written in them. From them I selected names for my pets. And it was the many little things recorded there that helped me to remember what my mother and father had already told me of different great lives and their works. And these books with these records made me very eager to be learning more and more of what was recorded in them. These two books I studied much more than I did my books at school. Their influence upon my life has been great. Listen to some of the names of her pets. Her shepherd dog was Brave Horatius. A baby chicken was Edmund Spencer. Elizabeth Barrett Browning was a pet cow with poetry in her tracks. A little squirrel was Geoffrey Chaucer. Even the trees had names. The tallest tree in the forest was Charlemagne. A grand fir tree with an understanding soul was named Michelangelo Sanzio Raphael. And her most dear lamb that needs to be mothered was Menander, Euripides, Theocritus, Thucydides. A mouthful for a 7-year-old, don't you think? Now let me continue this sampler as the publisher of her book picks up the story. Opal Whiteley, so her story runs, was born about 22 years ago, where we have no knowledge. Of her parents, whom she lost before her 5th year, she is sure of nothing except that they loved her, and that she loved them with a tenacity of affection as strong now as at the time of parting. To recall what manner of people they were, no physical proof remains except, perhaps, 2 precious little copybooks, which held their photographs, and wherein her mother and father had set down things which they wished their little daughter to learn, both of the world about her, and of that older world of legend and history, with which the diarist shows such capricious and entertaining familiarity. These books, for reason beyond her knowledge, were taken away from Opal when she was about 12 years of age, and have never been returned, although there is ground for believing that they are still in existence. Other curious clues to the identity of her father and mother came from the child's frequent use of French expressions, and sometimes of longer passages in French, and from her ready use of scientific terms. It is perhaps a fair inference that her father was a naturalist by profession or native taste, and that either he or her mother was French by birth or by education. After her parents' death, there is an interlude in Opal's recollection which she does not understand, remembering only that for a brief season the sweet tradition of her mother's care was carried on by an older woman, possibly a governess, from whom within a year she was taken, and after recovering from a serious illness, given to the wife of an Oregon lumberman, lately parted from her first child, Opal Whiteley, whose place and name, for reasons quite unknown, were given to the present Opal. From some time in her 6th year to the present, her diary has continued without serious interruption, and from the successive chapters we shall see that her life, apart from the gay tranquillity of her spirit, was not a happy one. Her friends were the animals and everything that flies or swims. Her single confidant was her diary, to which she confided every trouble and every satisfaction. When Opal was over 12 years old, a foster sister, in a tragic fit of childish temper, unearthed the hiding place of the diary and tore it into a myriad of fragments. The work of years seemed destroyed, but Opal, who had treasured its understanding pages, picked up the pitiful scraps and stored them in a secret box. There they lay undisturbed for many years. Last September, late one afternoon, Opal Whiteley came into the Atlantic's office with a book which she had printed in Los Angeles. It was not a promising errand, though it had brought her all the way from the western coast, hoping to have it published in regular fashion this volume, half fact, half fancy, of the fairyland around us, the fairyland of beasts and blossoms, butterflies and birds. The book was quaintly embellished with colored pictures, pasted in by hand, and bore 100 marks of special loving care. Yet about it there seemed little at first sight to tempt a publisher. Indeed, she had offered her wares in vain to more than one publishing house, and as her dollars were growing very few, the disappointment was severe. But about Opal Whiteley herself, there was something to attract the attention even of a man of business, something very young and eager and fluttering like a bird in a thicket. The talk went as follows. "I'm afraid we can't do anything with the book, but you must have had an interesting life. You have lived much in the woods." "Yes, in lots of lumber camps." "How many?" 19, at least. We moved 19 times." It was hard not to be interested now. One close question followed another regarding the surroundings of her girlhood. The answers were so detailed, so sharply remembered, that the next question was natural. "If you remember like that, you must have kept a diary." Her eyes opened wide. "Yes, always. I do still." "Then it is not the book I want, but the diary." She caught her breath. "It's destroyed. It's all torn up." Tears were in her eyes. "You loved it?" "Yes, I told it everything." "Then you kept the pieces." The guess was easy. What child whose doll is rent asunder throws away the sawdust? But she looked amazed. "Yes, I have kept everything. The pieces are all stored in Los Angeles." "We telegraphed for them, and they came, hundreds, thousands, one might almost say millions of them. Some few were large as a half sheet of notepaper, more scarce big enough to hold a letter of the alphabet. The paper was of all shades, sorts, and sizes. Butcher's bags pressed and sliced in two, wrapping paper, the backs of envelopes, anything and everything that could hold writing. The early years of the diary are printed in letters so close that when the sheets are fitted, not another letter can be squeezed in. In later passages, the characters are written with childish clumsiness, and later still one sees the gradually forming adult hand. The labor of piecing the diary together may fairly be described as enormous. For 9 months, almost continuously, the diarist has labored, piecing it together sheet by sheet, each page a kind of picture puzzle. Lettered for frugality, the store was precious on both sides of the paper. The entire diary, of which this volume covers but the two opening years, must comprise a total of 250,000 words. Upwards of 70,000, all that is contained in this volume, can be ascribed with more than reasonable definiteness to the end of Opal's sixth and to her seventh year. During all these months, Opal Whiteley has been a frequent visitor in the Atlantic's office. With friendliness came confidence, and little by little, very gradually, an incident here, another there, her story came to be told. She was at first eager only for the future, and for the opportunity to write and teach children of the world which she loved best. But as the thread of the diary was unraveled, she felt a growing interest in what her past had been and what lay behind her earliest recollections in the opening chapters of her printed record. If the story of Opal were written by another hand than her own, the central theme of it would be faith. No matter how doubtful the enterprise, the issue she always holds as certain, simply because the world is good and God loves his children. Loving herself, all created things, from her barrel full of caterpillars, whose evolution she would note and chronicle from day to day, to the dogs and horses, squirrels, raccoons, and bats which peopled the world she lived in, she would thank God daily for them, and very early in her life determined to devote the rest of it to so spreading knowledge of them and of their kind far and wide among little children. To accomplish this, she needed education, and an education she would have. Those about her showed no interest, but by picking berries, washing, and work of all rough sorts, Opal paid for the books which the high school required. But she must do more than this. She must go to college. To the state university she went, counting it nothing that she should live in a room without furniture other than a $2 cot and 2 coats for blankets. Family conditions, however, made college impossible for her. After the illness and death of Mrs. Whiteley, Opal borrowed a little money from friends in Cottage Grove, Oregon, and started a loan for Los Angeles, determined to seek her livelihood by giving nature lessons to classes of children. The privations and disappointments of the next 2 years would make an heroic tale, but she persevered, and her classes became successful. The next step was her nature book, for which, by personal canvas for subscriptions, she raised not less than the prodigious sum of $9,400. But the printers, with a girl for a client, demanded more and still more money, and when the final $600 necessary to make the booty mount to $10,000 was not forthcoming, with the brutality that would do credit to a Thénardier, first threatened and then destroyed the plates. A struggle for mere existence followed, but gradually Opal triumphed when she was overtaken by a serious illness and taken to the hospital. New and merciful friends, such as are always conjured up by such a life as Opal's, came to her assistance, and after her recovery she soon started eastward to find a publisher for her ill-fated volume. The rest we know. Yet, after all, our theme should not be Opal, but Opal's book. She is the child of curious and interesting circumstance, but of circumstance her journal is altogether independent. The authorship does not matter, nor the life from which it came. There the book is. Nothing else is like it, nor apt to be. If there is alchemy in nature, it is in children's hearts the unspoiled treasure lies, and for that room of the treasure house, the story of Opal offers a tiny golden key. Let me interject here. There were those who said she was a fraud. Mystery still surrounds her life. World certainly does veil the spirit, as the publisher said. But understanding hearts will feel the beauty and sincerity of her writings, and above all, her childlike faith in God, which never left her. Her Fairyland book was eventually published. She loved teaching children about nature and became known as the Sunshine Fairy all around the region of California where she taught. David Starr Jordan, the first president of Stanford University and a great soul that we'll talk about more in a few months, wrote this introduction to the book, which is a lesson to us as we study the importance of nature study in the lives of our children. It was a French storyteller who said, "We must lay up a stock of enthusiasms in our youth, or else we shall reach the end of our journey with an empty heart, for we lose a great many of them by the way." It is the finest part of education to fill the mind of youth with these enthusiasms, to teach him to know the world about him because he loves it, to love the world about him because he knows it, to make friends with all the things of nature, great and small, he meets when he goes forth every day, to know and love the little world about him, which is, after all, the fairer part of the great world we call the universe of God. And the joys of seeing and knowing and doing are the real joys of life. We may know a real joy from a spurious pleasure by this. It leaves no sting. It brings no weakness. It clears the way for more joys and more strength. Moreover, as Agassiz used to say, this is the charm of nature herself. She brings us back to absolute truth every time we wander. This is a word of greeting to a unique nature book, the work of a young woman who is a real lover of nature. It is an effort to give our boys and girls a right start in the joys of life. It opens their eyes to the charms and glory shown all around them. It draws them toward a sympathy with the problems of life, which beset every man and beast and bird among us, and which one way or another we are called on to solve. It swells the stock of these youthful enthusiasms, which, so long as they last, keep the heart young and make life the better worth living. His words were followed by the publisher of the book. God's wonder world is very largely wasted on us nowadays because we pay no attention to it. We don't see the beauty in the blade of grass, nor in the drop of rain, nor in the love-making of the flower, nor in the industry of the bee, nor the reason why some birds have beautiful songs and others beautiful coats. We would not turn around even a city lot without finding something to fascinate us if we had either the knowledge or the imagination to see what is there. Entirely aside from the spiritual and educational value of this beautiful book, it is of very serious material worth. As every mother knows, the way to keep youngsters out of mischief is to employ their minds and hands. Any youngster who becomes interested in the birds and flowers and beasties will have a lot of mental occupation and no real excuse for getting into mischief. For this utilitarian reason alone, the book will pay for itself many times over. Anyone who has studied nature in any sense or knows the outdoors must welcome everything that in an honest, competent way calls any attention in the wonder world right under our noses, to which we have become nearly blind. And this book is very worthy in this important responsibility. The fact that this tireless young woman has financed the book by her own efforts, has been her own publisher and circulator, adds interest. It is a notable achievement for a girl of 20. I hope I've piqued your interest. And by the way, Barbara Cooney illustrated a beautiful little picture book called Only Opal that you may be able to find in your public library. But it would be a worthwhile addition to own a copy that will introduce your very youngest children to her story and love of nature. Sadly, Opal spent the last 50 years of her life in a psychiatric hospital in England where she was known as the Princess. And they said she behaved as one. She committed herself. Perhaps the stresses of life were too great for her, and at least she felt safe there. She was buried at Highgate Cemetery. Her tombstone bears her name and the simple inscription, "I spake as a child." It's fitting to close this podcast with her words. Now, brave Horatius and me and Thomas Chatterton, Jupiter Zeus, are going to prayers in the cathedral. The great pine tree is saying a poem, and there is a song in the treetops. Bye-bye. See you next time.